gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome and thank you for tuning in today. It is great to have you here. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is a program that could focus on a lot of different topics that we find to be interesting and, of course, important, both from a political point of view, but also in relation to meta-politics, hidden agendas, and subversive movements. We talk about how we are being manipulated with skewed history, prehistory, but also questions of origins and human nature, and much more. If you zoom out and look at the big picture and question why things are the way they are, I think you realize that a lot of things are connected and related, and you have to dig deep to get to the roots. You can find a lot more of these inquiries and, of course, our radio shows on redicecreations.com. Today we have Josh Reeves back on the program. He is a Dallas, Texas-based researcher, filmmaker, and radio talk show host behind The Global Reality. He has made several documentaries and mini-documentaries, and his latest one is called The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, the second volume. We'll go into a lot of the unknown history of the American continent. We discuss who arrived there first, who developed society there, and of course how this has been covered up. Hey Josh, welcome back. Good to have you on again. Thank you for being here. It was a while ago, I think over a year ago, so I hope you've been doing well since we last spoke.
Well, thank you, Henrik. It's really great to be back with you again, and I'm looking forward to talking about all the stuff we're going to be talking about here today.
Let's just kind of remind our listeners a bit here about Volume 1. We have a lot of new people coming aboard and a lot of new listeners and everything else. Last time you were with us, obviously, we kind of spoke about the importance of the rock wall and basically that this is kind of in your background and this kind of started your path onto wanting to do this series overall, Josh. I mean, so before we kind of get into the details and the nuggets of Volume 2 a bit here, just tell us how you got onto this and almost what the main drive has been for you to create and do this series. It's been preoccupying a lot of your time in, what is it, the last few years, really, Josh, is a huge dedication behind this.
Absolutely, yeah. It really started for me from, as you mentioned, this rock wall thing, and that's what really got me into researching ancient mysteries. I really didn't have much of an interest in that stuff before that. You know, I'd always been somebody who had researched, the wide range of topics that really cover everything from global government to secret societies. I'd really been into all the different type of things that most people really relate to as far as this information goes, but I had been reading a book back in 2004 that had mentioned this rock wall thing, and after having many experiences in this area that I couldn't explain, kind of a light bulb went off in my head and said, you know, I think this is somehow connected to this, and I was more right than I would have ever imagined. So it's really been almost about a 10-year research effort before I ever even made Volume 1, which, as you mentioned, came out last year, which we talked about here on the show. And I never dreamed that it would take me down as many roads as it took me down. I would never dream that it would go beyond just being this little localized thing here in the Dallas area where I live to being something that connects to not only the great bigger picture about the ancient history of the Americas, but also connects to the much larger unexplained picture of all societies and all things around the world. And it also unexpectedly ties directly into right back into the things that I thought I was kind of leaving behind for a minute. You know, I didn't really think that this research would tie into the overarching grandmaster plan of the world conspiracy. I never really thought that any of that would tie in. And I have, as I've researched and as I've done more, I found out that it absolutely does. So I've kind of come full circle on all of this. But really, the main thing is that this discovering that the ancient past of the Americas directly ties in with the ancient past of all countries and all peoples, and finding out that it's intimately connected with these things that you kind of thought were separate has been really a big, big game changer for me. And this is something that we've continued to do with Volume 2 as well. And now we're in production on Volume 3. So, it's definitely exciting. And there's a lot more to it, I think, than most people even realize.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's really interesting and huge story here, you know, and it's actually a political one. It is one that has immense amount of tentacles when you actually get into all of this. And as I was watching your film, Josh, a lot of things actually sparked in my mind as to, you know, what the reasoning and the agenda behind some of this is, and we'll see if we can get into some of that later. But obviously, the question about who, you know, who came to America first, you know, these are questions that are politicized today. You know, it's like kind of this who owns it kind of discussion. I mean, we have a lot of research coming from, actually, interestingly enough, a lot of different political kind of leanings and agendas, and I have as I watched some of this stuff, some things actually fell into place for me as well. So we'll see if we can get into that later, and some of the people that you do go into there, you know, it's very important. But tell us a bit first about the sites you wanted to kind of visit, and how you picked these on some of the basis of what you looked at in Volume 1, that you had, I guess, at that point, kind of a distinct, clear path. That, like, okay, these are the major sites. I got to go to these, try to check them out for myself. And, of course, also, I was surprised to see that a lot of them were restricted access to them. A lot of them are actually cornered off. You can't really get in there. Tell us about the nature of that.
Yeah, that's something that we've encountered again on Volume 2 as well, is that, you know, a lot of these sites, you know, there are access restricted and things. But I really, at first, really didn't have a clear set path on the sites I wanted to visit. When I did Volume 1, really what I came at it from was, I studied the rock wall, I started saying, okay, we've got to try to work around whether or not we believe this is a natural or a man-made formation. If we're coming at this as this being non-natural, then we have to try and find out if other things that are found around this in the same area have been found in other places. So I started looking into the phenomenon of mounds, because mounds surround the rock wall. The whole little town of the downtown square is built on top of a giant mound, which is said to house an ancient temple room inside of it, according to some spelunkers and archaeologists who went back there in the 1920s. So again, the reports of giant skeletons being found around the rock wall, all these things were the little leads that said, okay, if we can find examples of these same type of things in other places, then we're going to know this is not just an isolated situation or an isolated building structure. We're going to know this is something that ties into the whole thing. So I just kind of started slowly looking at different things I could find, looking at different mound sites and whatnot, and finding out that many of these sites have alignments which correspond to sites all over the world, and you see these same exact alignments. Every site I've been to so far across the United States all have these exact alignments, these alignments to summer solstice and equinox events, and some of them even have more alignments than that. So again, I just started looking at, all right, let's see what is here. And so in Volume 1, which is almost 4 hours long, we started really going to just a few rudimentary places. But for Volume 2, we got to go to quite a few places which I had been really just dreaming about going to for a long time. We got to explore, and people see that in Volume 2 of this film. We really got to go to places like the Serpent Mound in Ohio, the whole entire Ohio Valley, which we cover, which is just an unbelievable – that was just an unbelievable experience going to Ohio itself. Yeah. I really highly suggest people go there on their own if they get a chance, because the landscape is completely – you can't go 5 feet and throw a rock without hitting a mound or some kind of ancient site in the Ohio Valley. So that was a really big one for me. Also, the Cahokia Mounds in southern Missouri, southern Illinois right there. That was another big one for me that we got to go to, as well as places like Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, and the Lovelock Caves in Nevada. Just a lot of these places where, again, we had heard tales of there being giant skeletons found, or we had seen these alignments that line up. My interest in Chaco Canyon really came from the fact that I had seen pictures of masonry walls there that looked just like the rock wall walls. And that was really as far as I went. I had known about Chaco Canyon for quite some time, but never really had a big interest in it. And then once I went there, and what was, as you mentioned, you know, some of this stuff is so difficult to get to if you can't even get to it at all. And Chaco Canyon, it's about, it's the closest, I think the closest town is like Albuquerque. It's like 3 hours west of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm. You drive and drive and drive, you get out there, and then when you get to the road that takes you to where Chaco Canyon is, it's a 13-mile trek down this graded road that completely shakes your car. You can't drive more than like 15 miles an hour, and it takes, you know, at that speed, takes forever to get to it. And the first thing you see when you get there is this gigantic, you know, UN, UNESCO World Heritage Site plaque. So you see this and you go, okay, well, this is, you know, this is a known site. This is something that the highest people in positions of power are aware of. They have designated this as a UN protected biosphere, but they make it very, very difficult. Very, very difficult to get to. Unlike places like the Grand Canyon, which we also have traveled to now to cover for Volume 3, and getting out there to Chaco Canyon and seeing this stuff for yourself is just an unbelievable thing. You see these little doors that have really no explanation. All the doors are line of sight. You see these alignments that there's also solar and lunar alignments contained within the walls of Chaco Canyon. And what's very mind-blowing to me is that some of these events, these lunar events that are encoded into the structures at Chaco, which are marked when these events occur again, some of these happen in some cases only once every couple of hundred years. And so you get the idea when you go out there that someone would have had to have lived in this area for hundreds of years before any of the structures were ever built in order to know which of these lunar cycles and solar cycles cycles happen enough to encode them into the bricks of Chaco Canyon. So getting out there and seeing all that stuff and then taking pictures and realizing that, you know, we didn't really realize it at the time, but finding out that we would find direct evidence that would link the Chaco Canyon structures to the rock wall. Again, I had just saw the way the rocks were stacked, and that's what piqued my interest. But finding out that these boreholes, which we talk about in the new film, Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 2, these boreholes that I've found in places all over the country, I mean, now we'll talk about them much more extensively in Volume 3. We found them now in places just all over the country. And almost every site we visited, from ancient Anasazi ruins, the Grand Canyon, everywhere, these boreholes, which appear to be made by some ancient tool, they are not new tool marks, and we find those at Chaco Canyon the same as we find them in stones of the rock wall, as well as these metal rings that are made of iron that were located in the rock wall. We also have found those and have pictures of those in the movie at Chaco Canyon, and I've presented these to several experts who've been studying Chaco Canyon for years and years, and they were completely blown away and gave me the indication that I've discovered something completely new no one else has ever found there. And then when I show them the pictures of the rock wall iron rings, they're completely blown away by that. And the ones that are found in the rock wall I've actually held in my hand before, and they've been dated to something like 7,000 years old, and they're smelted of iron, copper, aluminum, and tin. And you know, we know nobody back 7,000 years ago that we, of course, that we know of, mm-hmm. that we're told anyway, was doing that kind of metallurgy and that kind of putting together. So, again, these sites have been really an eye-opener for me, Henrik. When you go out to them yourself and you go out there, you experience things and you see things that you're not just going to see or experience being behind the computer and researching this on the internet. Yeah. You have to get out there in the field and see the stuff for yourself.
Well, exactly. That's the way to go. That's the way we got to proceed, you know, to get to some answers. And I would say that that's concerning everything, basically. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
We have to inform ourselves. We have to learn. We have to study. But coupling that with actually, you know, doing something and getting out there, that's absolutely key in the next step of finding out here. But a little bit later here, I wanted to get into why the protection of the sites, you know, why this is being covered up, because, you know, as we know, we have to get to the core of origins to know who we are, where we come from, even if this entails, you know, different types of humans that has lived on the planet. This is, I believe, intricately involved with where we come out of, you know, and because, unfortunately, anthropology has been politicized. The paleo police, as some call them, actually taking control of the story of our origins for very distinct reasons, and they're using it in different capacities today, I believe, for political purposes. We'll see if we get into that later. But what is the big picture here? If we zoom out a bit, Josh, and look at the kind of the main thesis that has developed as you've been working on this and looking into this, I don't know if you had an idea first of kind of where you wanted to go and this drove you to where to go and look into what, or if this is something that's actually shaped along the way, and consequently if the thesis, if you will, have actually changed now as you've done volume 2 and 3.
Yes, that last description, Henrik, was the perfect description of how it's gone. It's not something I ever had a predetermined viewpoint on, and I think that that is key in almost every investigation. You know, if you have someone, a person or investigator, that is sort of already has their thesis established and they're working to prove that thesis, I think that sometimes you can get skewed data, skewed information. You get stuff that sometimes can lean towards that person's own individual belief system. But thankfully for me, coming into this, I had no pre-existing beliefs that were structured that needed to be torn down or anything. So everything has been really just an organic finding, and as you said, an organic putting together of the grand big picture. And what I've found and what I've seen with this that really was an eye-opener for me through this whole experience has been just how long there have been, you know, whether you want to call them humans or whatever they may be. I don't think we have all the answers for that yet, but there have been entities, people, there have been things going on this planet. There have been civilizations rising, falling. There have been people existing for periods of time and then being wiped out in cataclysms for so much longer than mainstream science and in many cases even alternative researchers have really let themselves on to be. It's been mind-blowing for me to find out things like these, you know, like these artifacts being found in a well in Illinois, you know, this coin that has hieroglyphs on it that have only ever been found in one place, and that's this 2.5-ton garnet stone that was found near Rockwall, and for these hieroglyphs to match up. And when you think about the fact that that artifact found in a well in Illinois was found in a soil strata that dated to like 250,000 years, you start to see that, okay, the dating, the how far back the dates go on all of these sites have really become a problem for the narrative or the accepted narrative of the scientific community and the public at large. And when you start to see these narratives being broken down with hard data and facts and evidence that are being found in these ancient sites and these ancient relics and everything else, that's when I started to understand that, okay, this is a significant problem for the power structure, because if people start to realize the extent and the level to which they've been lied to on something as rudimentary or something really as that most people might not see as important as other topics, but if you see that they've been lied to on this scale about this stuff, I think it starts to unravel things, and they're afraid it may unravel things even further when people start to realize, well, if we've been lied to about this, and we know we've been lied to about this topic and this over here and everything else. Again, it's just that it's another piece of the puzzle, Henrik, and I think that at this point that's what they're afraid of, is the complete unraveling and the complete loss of integrity and the public believability of their official narratives of the timeline of man.
Right, exactly. Now, is the giant, do you think that the key element here? I know that some researchers, I think yourself included, looking at the possibility that we do need to go off world to kind of explain some of the ongoings. Some people do not do that. They think it's sufficient evidence to suggest that we might have had remarkable pre-civilizations here on the planet. There's a number of different ways we can kind of approach this. How has this developed for you, that dichotomy, Josh?
My thing about it is that I go back and forth with it, Henrik. You know, I mean, I go back and forth with all this stuff because I don't tend to allow myself to get too locked in to believing one thing one way or the other for too long, because oftentimes you find something else that comes along and smashes that or replaces that idea. But I don't think it's necessary to be locked into an ideology that all of this is 100% off world, and I don't think it's important to be locked into an ideology that it's 100% not. I think that, well, as with most of this stuff, it's an open investigation. We really should not come to any concrete beliefs or conclusions until we have all the evidence. But with the giant thing for me, I mean, there's a lot of different plausible explanations for this. There are some that are implausible. There are some that we really just don't have all the evidence to yet. So, I don't think that if you believe, all of this has to do with extraterrestrials or, ancient gods that came from the sky, I don't think that that's wrong for you to think that. If you think that there's a more earthly explanation for it, and maybe this just had to do with, pre-flood oxygen levels being much higher on the planet and things grew larger, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. I think it's more important at this stage that we look at these unexplained things, especially the engineering, some of the engineering that has gone on in these sites. That's something that I've found since last we talked that really blew me away about all the mounds, finding out that these mounds were not just lumps of dirt. They were actually very, very structurally engineered structures that used, in many cases, different types of dirt that were found hundreds and hundreds of miles away from each other, in many cases, so that these structures would stand the test of time. And things like the niobium content that was found in the rock wall, when you look at niobium being a material that we didn't even find out about until the late 1800s, one that we use to bring the heat down at any sort of activity, such as pipelines and rocket engines, and the fact that this is found in the rock wall is only put there because it's a structural engineering material that you would use to reinforce some kind of structure, the same way we do today. So those are the things I think, Henrik, are more important to point out, are these engineering skills, these things that pertain to religious practices, specifically ones that pertain to the Egyptian books of the dead, that are mirrored in these ancient sites in America, that according to, if we believe what we're told about mainstream accepted history, there's no possible way these civilizations in America could have had these Egyptian funerary practices and whatnot in any knowledge of it whatsoever. So, again, I don't think that I don't think it's important that anybody get locked into an ideology, but I think when we start to see the stuff that it has absolutely no plausible explanation, those are the things that I've tried to key in on and put together and show how they connect from one side to the other. And in future films, I'm also going to be showing how these connect to other sites around the world. I recently got to meet the gentleman who found and has been doing the work on the Bosnian pyramids, Dr. Sam Osmanovic. And it's amazing how many correlations that he and I have found between the Bosnian pyramids and the rock wall. They both have so many similarities in their makeup and in their piezoelectrical energy production. So, again, I think this is something that, as I've kind of come at it from the standpoint of really only covering what is in my own backyard here in the United States, it's amazing to see how now people are finding my work and they're coming to me and saying, hey, this ties into something I found in Ireland, or this ties into something I found in Russia. It really is something where each individual person's own unique research efforts, and I think that should be this way with all research efforts, we're starting to find how everything else connects, and when we put it all out there, I think we'll eventually be able to give ourselves a grand, bigger picture and a better idea of what's going on, and we'll have a lot less speculation.
Now, excavation-wise, how has this been performed on many of the mounds that you talked about? Because I mentioned this specifically because I know how much of this is lacking in my own country and other parts of Europe as well, that there is a propensity to basically just avoid doing any kind of their research, but very lightly. But in most cases, you have to go to sources that is earlier than 1920s or something like that. I think, again, before this time, when things kind of becomes weaponized, the anthropology and the research on this kind of stuff. And so the more accurate records is not only the myths and stuff where you can actually glean a lot from whatever, kind of stories is local to the regions, but also to see whatever, those Europeans who come to these sites and done the work, that seems to be the most fair, open, and honest in the beginning. And what's funny about that is in most cases, too, that is when it seems most sensationalistic, actually, if I can put it that way, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the farther you go back with any of this stuff, the more that you find stuff that, as you mentioned, sounds just sensational. Sounds nuts. But that post Smithsonian era is when you started to have, you know, stuff where it was like, okay, we're not really getting anything from this. This has been deleted and everything's been redacted from this. But there is, as far as the excavations going on and have going on in this country, stuff changes every day, and they constantly seem, every time that I put one of these films out, to all of a sudden be interested in a lot of these sites they were interested in before. For instance, the Spiro Mounds, which we cover in Lost Secrets Volume 1, there has not been any excavations on those sites in over 30 years, I think 1982, 1983. And about 6 months ago, they announced that this year there would be new excavations going on at the Spiro Mounds for the first time in over 30 years, and some of these would actually be open to the public. And that it came out after the film was released. And then this year, since Volume 2 has come out, we've had new excavations going on at the Cahokia Mounds in Illinois, which are challenging the already pre-accepted beliefs of that culture, where they're finding all sorts of new roads, structures. I talk about in Volume 2 how underneath Cahokia there's actually a stone structure that's been found underneath the dirt, indicating that this thing was a much larger stone pyramid way, way, way back older, even before the mound itself was built. We also see new stuff that just came out, I think, this week pertaining to the Serpent Mound. And I talk specifically about in the film about how the powers that be have tried to attribute the construction of the Serpent Mound to the Fort Ancient culture, wrongly associating that with that. And I also talked about how probably the reason why they never wanted to attribute that to the true builders, the Adena culture, because the Adena culture were known to be giants. And they just came out this week with more information saying, oh, well, okay, we're going to change this now. We think we were wrong. We think maybe it was the Adena culture who built this. And we've also seen the same thing going on at Chaco Canyon. Chaco Canyon has had new information come out about it this year, just since we've released this film in February. And so I think that there is a constant shift going on. I think they are afraid that independent researchers like myself and like people who come on this show are now becoming a significant threat to something that hasn't really been challenged ever. You know, these people have been comfortable for years not being challenged by any conflicting information. But now that you have independent researchers and people who are pulling back the threads of this, it is causing the establishment, who, as you mentioned, have normally just gone out to these sites and done a little rudimentary digging and said, okay, here's this, here's that, and that's all that's here. Let's cover it back up and let's move on. Now they're starting to say, okay, well, we've got to start admitting to some of this, because the pressure is starting to come on. And again, as you mentioned, that unraveling of the narrative, it seems to be consistently one of the things that they're most afraid of.
Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit more about Lovelock Cave and what actually happened there. We have some interesting stories about giants being, you know, cornered in this area, and it's eerily reminiscent of some of the stories we've heard about Neanderthals in Europe, and how these were actually hunted to the point of extinction. And there's various reasons for why this might be. We had did a very interesting program with the gentleman who talked about the potential conflict, of course, between you know, Cro-Magnon and Neanderthals at the time, and that basically they were predatory on Cro-Magnon, and this eventually sparked a survival instinct and a revenge, really, which is a potentiality of why they drove them to extinction. And there's even that classic rock in Gibraltar in Portugal, a cave system underneath where it's believed that some of the last remains of Neanderthals still is, that they literally drove them to the edge of the European continent and cornered them there. But in this case, we have another scenario here as well. We have red-haired giants being largely genocided by the local culture, I guess we could call it, for the lack of a better term. What was some of the reasoning, do you think, behind that, and what happened at Lovelock Cave?
Well, it's a fascinating story. And Lovelock Cave is just, if you ever are entertaining going out to this place, let me warn you ahead of time, it is quite the trek, and it's very, very treacherous getting out to where this thing is at. It takes something like 6 hours. If you go to Nevada and you drive in from the south as we did, once you get to Las Vegas, it's basically 6 hours. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but through
That's
desert, through desert terrains that never change. I mean, both we did this, you know, two ways. It was some. It was really some of the most just treacherous and hardcore driving and traveling that we've done to go to a site. And we actually almost got stranded at Lovelock Cave and had a flat tire and got stranded out there. We did get stranded out there for a while and after dark, and there was very interesting light show in the sky while we were out there. But this Lovelock Cave, I tell you what, getting out there when we first got to this place, there was right near it. I wouldn't say right near it for out in the middle of nowhere, but probably about seven miles away or so, they have a little Lovelock Museum, and we drove by and they were closed. And I was like, wow, I really wanted to go there because I'd heard that inside of this Lovelock Museum, they actually have the remains and the skeletal remains of one of these giants that were found near Lovelock Cave. And I have found out subsequently that they have taken it off of public display, but they have it in the back. And if you go there, you can actually, you know, say, hey, you know, can you take me in the back and show me this thing? And they'll show it to you. So I was hoping to get a chance to do that. But once we made it to the to where the actual cave was, it was very interesting to see just how in our modern day perception of this, the cave seemed to be in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert. Upon research, and as I talk about in Lost Secrets 2, we find out that this entire area where this cave was located at in the time when these giants would have been alive was once a massive, massive lake system that spread throughout that area of Nevada that at the time in which it was fertile and going was much, much bigger than the Great Lakes of the Americas. And so these caves actually, at the time in which the they were trapped there, the giants were trapped in it, would have actually almost been an island,
right? Yeah,
in
exactly.
The middle of this water. So it's very strange that they would find all of the things they found there. They found duck decoys and they found these various plants and whatnot. But then you start to look at they say, okay, well these giant skeletons, they're, you know, they're a couple thousand years old or whatever. But then you start to realize that there hasn't been water at all in that area in something called like 13,000 years. So the story, the narrative really starts to come apart there. But getting inside of the cave and being inside of this place, you do kind of get the feeling that, yeah, there was something bad going on here. And I was kind of perplexed at first, Henry, because they talked about, again, as you mentioned, they talked about these giants being red-haired giants. And the reason that they were hunted to extinction by the Paiute tribe was that the story is that they were basically becoming a menace to the local tribes, and in some cases they were eating the local tribesmen. And this really shocked me because it ran contrary to all the other information and research I had done. We had heard, and I was shocked when I did Lost Secrets Volume 1 to find out that there were two distinctly different types of giants and giant skeletons and remains that had been found, a dark-haired, more savage, cannibalistic variety, and a red-haired variety that seemed to be benevolent and really trying to help any of the local people. So it really was perplexing for me to hear that, okay, this, you know, this really doesn't fit in with everything else we found. These red-haired giants were never said to be cannibals. Of course, we find out later on that because of, you know, long expanses of time and being buried in iron-rich dirt like you find out there in the desert, eventually the dark hair turns to red. And so I think this is where a lot of the confusion came from. But the people, the Paiute tribes, which still exist in that area, and they also exist to this day at a lake that's a smaller portion of this once massive Lake Lahontan there in Nevada. Well, what's left is this little area called Pyramid Lake, which we cover in Volume 2. And the local people seem to have secrets that to this day they don't want to let out. And when you look at these pyramid structures that they make it impossible to get to, we thought we were going to be able to go and just shoot this pyramid tufa rock formation. It kind of looks like a ziggurat, and it's in the middle of this lake. And it's only, you're only talking about maybe 30 minutes away from where Lovelock Cave is. So we had had the impression we were going to go out there and get footage of this, no problem. And we go up to the gift shop, and the first thing we see at this little visitor center is a strange, looks like a Wookiee. It looks like something out of Star Wars. It's this strange Wookiee-like creature. No one has any explanation for what this giant statue is out inside of the place. And we're sitting there going, okay, this is very perplexing. We get in, we start asking, okay, how do we get out to the Pyramid Lake Rock to film it? And the guy says, oh, well, you don't. And if you want to, then you have to pay the local Paiute tribe $1,000, and then they get to dictate what you're going to put in your film. And I just said, well, you know, I can't believe I drove, because I looked at their site and everything, no mention of this. I drove thousands of miles to get here. And he says, basically, you know, give us some money, and we'll get you over there. And I said, well, I'm absolutely not going to do that. But it was interesting to find out that the reason why these they're so protective, it seems, is there about 2 weeks after I was there, an article came out about some dating that they had recently done on some of the petroglyphs that we saw out there near the Pyramid Lake. And these petroglyphs turned out to be the oldest petroglyphs ever found in the United States. And they fall in the date of that 13,000-year event, whatever the worldwide catastrophe was, tying in exactly to the time in which there would have been water still in that area that led from Pyramid Lake all the way to where the Lovelock Cave was. So I said, wait a minute. The oldest petroglyphs ever found, giant skeletons, time periods that tied directly into the exact period when we are led to believe that the supposed cataclysm, worldwide cataclysm, happened. All of this stuff cannot be a coincidence, especially when we start looking at astrological alignments. We start looking at the fact that I found that they had some kind of giant sphinx on the other side of the lake where near the pyramid was that we couldn't get to. They had a giant sphinx carved out of rock over there. The fascinating thing was that after the initial skeletons that were found in the Lovelock Cave were found, two more were later found by the local Paiute tribes. They've been reburied in another location, and the Paiute tribes will not let anybody know where these other skeletons are at, and they won't let anybody have any access to them. And I find that these contradictions in their official stories are just mind-blowing, because they claim that the reason why they can't let anybody have access to the giant skeletons is that they are, in fact, the ancestors of the Paiute people. But the Paiute people's own stories claim that these giants were savages and wiping out their people. It just seems odd that they would simultaneously be their ancestors and also their enemy. And right. I think that that's where we start to see this idea that, okay, we're talking about something that happened so long ago that prior to the giants and the Paiute tribe being enemies, at some point, there had to have been some sort of interbreeding going on that eventually led to there being the smaller people who were the ancestors of these giants, and then later on subsequently being a fallout where they were hunted to extinction. And the Paiute tribe to this day still holds this stuff with great secrecy. But as we talk about in the film, I started finding out about this group of beings called the Havmasuves that supposedly existed and lived in subterranean chambers and cities within the mountain areas around Lake Lahontan and around where Lovelock Cave is, even way back farther than when these giant skeletons were even found. So we may be even dealing with two different types of individuals or two different groups or cultures here. It does seem that that these giants are not the one and only explanation for things. I think it's definitely true that they were here, definitely true that they had some sort of a hand in all of this stuff, certainly in the seeding of the tribal structures of the Native Americans, especially with many of the Native American tribes having these names that came from giants. In Alabama, of course, we have the city of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and some people don't even know, even though the city of Tuscaloosa readily admits this, if you go there, that their name of the city Tuscaloosa was actually named after a giant who had the name Tuscaloosa, and he was actually discovered by Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark came up through Florida on their expedition, and they came to this giant mound, and there was a giant seated in the lotus position on top of this mound who had his smaller tribesmen below him. So, you know, I think that these guys definitely had an influence and a hand here. But I don't think they were the only ones. The evidence does not support that they were the only ones here. The evidence does support that there was other beings, possibly that came from within the Earth and not from, you know, outer space or wherever else that we've been convinced. That's the thing that I've really found, Henry, that I think is important, that as you kind of mentioned earlier, you know, it doesn't, there's not always 100% evidence that all of this stuff and all these people necessarily came from space. They may have come from other places as well.
Well, there seems to have been tons of other types of humanoids, other races, other, you know, types of you know, human, you know, kind of groups that have existed, I mean, not only in Europe, but in North America as well. I mean, just look at, God, I mean, the comparison with Beowulf and Grendel here, you know, the Scandinavian story. I mean, I've brought that up many times, but it's just so reminiscent of one who kind of turns on the local population and this king, Beowulf, from the lands of the Goths, you know, where I'm born. He travels to Denmark over there to kind of take care of this problem because this giant has started to harass and eat a lot of the native people there, you know. And it's like, what if that is the truth? You know, what how does that alter the picture? And I mean, it's incredible. But the secrecy and cover up is a huge portion of this, and we can see that there has been a politicized faction here as well, actually trying to cover up, and they're doing that actually today with the aid of this incredible sensitivity issues and political correctness and everything else. A good example of this is, for example, the Kennewick Man, where unfortunately we had the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act actually standing in the way of this as a gatekeeper, where, you know, according to the current law, the Kennewick Man would have been classified as Native American, regardless or not whether there actually is any link to a contemporary tribe that lived in the area at that time. I mean, I think there were seven different anthropologists that ended up suing the United States due to the right that they wanted to conduct tests on the skeleton. But this have now kept this issue away from it. It's been kept gatekept by the Native American community in a way that they're not allowed to touch it, they're not allowed to look into it. And I find that highly you know, disappointing, actually, to be honest, where we no longer can do any proper scientific investigation of it, again, due to kind of a politicized, sensitive issue, Josh.
You hit the nail on the head there, Hendrick. I mean, you absolutely hit the nail on the head as far as the situation that's going on. I've encountered this. This is something I've talked about in the newest film as well. There's no question about it that, and you know, this is touchy area, Hendrick. You know, a lot of people don't like going there, and I'm just one of those people where I'm not afraid to go.
No,
you
exactly.
Have to.
We have to.
You can't concern yourself with whether or not you're going to be, you know, because a lot of people see this as they consider it racist. You know,
yeah, let me talk about that later. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, for you to even insinuate that somehow these, you know, for me to even insinuate that somehow a lot of these structures and whatnot were built by someone other than Native Americans is considered by many people absolute racist blasphemy. I mean, it actually is.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And it's so when you start to find that, as you mentioned, these Native Americans have been put in, they have been absolutely put in a position to be gatekeepers. They have been fed a false narrative of their history, and they have been given responsibility under the guise of being, oh, well, we'll just give them, these are their native lands, and we'll give them these to protect it. And really, it's they've been put there and given the power to be gatekeepers. And this stemmed from the fact that prior to the manifest destiny in this country where, you know, they deemed, okay, you know, Native Americans, they're savage, ruthless people, they're primitives, they have nothing worth preserving, so they should be wiped out and we should take their lands. Well, prior to that happening, the predominantly held scientific belief by all the top minds in the United States was that the ancient sites throughout the United States were not built by Native Americans, but were actually built by a separate culture and a separate race of people that they referred to at that time as the mound builders. And these mound building cultures were said and believed to at that time be a completely separate race that really came to fruition in another location, came, set up shop in the United States, and then, of course, the Native Americans came after it. This was held by Thomas Jefferson. This was held by all the big minds of the time. And after Manifest Destiny happened, after they went in, took all their lands, they, all of a sudden, once everything was done, they said, oh, we're sorry. Oh, no, we screwed up. Oh, no, actually, there wasn't a separate race of mound builders. Actually, the Native Americans were responsible for this, even though many of the elders said, we didn't do this. Mm-hmm. No, this isn't our stuff. This was here before the red man came.
Yeah.
They said that in many cases. That didn't matter to the United States government. They said, no, You're responsible for it. This is yours. We'll put you on these lands. And then we'll basically, they set them up with this false narrative that has now allowed them in the eyes of the public to take responsibility for things that they had no responsibility for. And I'll tell you the key thing, and we talk about this in Lost Secrets 2, the key thing to understand about this and the way that this smashes, Henrik, this idea of this being some kind of a racist ideology is the fact whether you look into the base 60 numerical system, you look at the numerical system that was used in places like the Serpent Mound, this numerical system that goes back to the Babylonians that was used in the same way to calculate their gods, you start to see that the Native Americans had no idea of the sexagesimal number system. They had no knowledge of this whatsoever. It was not included in anything else. There was no reason why they should have had this information, and it is encoded into these ancient sites that you find all across the Ohio Valley that are being associated with Native Americans. The fact of the matter is they did not have the scientific, the engineering, or the astrological skills to be able to be responsible for these ancient sites in America. And, again, just talking about that and believing that, even though the information supports it, it can, in the eyes of many people, make you seem like a racist. It's just unbelievable how they keep the mind in shackles.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, again, this is due to the fact that, let's face it, these days no one dares to touch this area or even criticize them, right? It's so guilt-ridden that this is why it's one of the most efficient ways of doing it. And I believe as well, see if we can get into more detail about this later on, but just a quick passing here. I've noticed, because as you went in a little bit to some of the openings there, you know, with the History Channel, what they've been trying to do and everything else, and I think that there's a question of controlled opposition within this picture as well, where you have a clear kind of, almost to a point where it's just stupid and nonsensical, kind of a straw man, really, of a racist ideology that lies on top of this, when you can see, for example, very clear connections between people who actually joined the American National Socialist Party, for example. I mean, as we know, I mean, look at it. I mean, the FBI has practically run these white supremacist groups, you know, since the start now. It's a way to actually, again, any legitimate, what I'm getting at is that any legitimate studies that are done on this, when you actually go into things like the Clovis culture, the Solutrians, and very, very hardline, excellent research, you know, that actually is done by some of the people like Dennis Stanford, and you have another Bruce Bradley, for example, they've done some fantastic research and work on this, and it's very meticulous, it's very good scientific and everything else. It details the highly likely possibility that from, you know, France, Spain, and Portugal, you know, roughly 21 to 17,000 years ago, the Solutrians ended up walking over, you know, the ice or something like that, the tool-making industry that kind of disappeared from Europe at the time and shows up on the American continent at that time. If you can take that very valid type of research and connect it with something or associated in people's head that basically when you begin talking about those kinds of things, there was a European on the American continent before the you know, Asian walks over the Bering Strait up there through Russia, then, oh, no, that's all racist. See, that's all these neo-Nazis are writing these books and trying to do it in this way, and therefore, it's all a big ruse, it's all a big straw man, right? So now, let's not even talk about that, and let's not even focus on the real research that's been done on this. Again, that's my point. Anthropology has become weaponized. It's a political tool today, and it's connected with political correctness and cultural Marxism and all kinds of nonsense you can just imagine. So it's very efficient. But, of course, what's the big issue and what's the big question mark here? It is, what is being lost here? What are we losing out on instead of just focusing on these political issues? It's the truth, of course, of the matter, so we can get to the heart of the matter and start to, you know, realize what actually really has been going on the North American continent to try to solve and actually really heal some of the wounds that have appeared as well, right?
Yeah, they're baffled by the evidence, Henrik. I mean, that's the main thing, is that they're just baffled by the proof that comes out. I get into this a little bit towards the end of Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 1. I show a clip in there, as you probably remember, where you have several prominent, very prominent black actors, people such as Chris Rock and I think Tina Turner, just several big names, and who all grew up having stories in their family that they had Native American or Indian in their family somewhere. And all these famous actors all had stories, this going back to their grandmothers. Oh, my grandmother had Indian hair, this, that, and the other. And then they do DNA analysis on all of these famous actors who claim this Indian heritage, and come to find out, none of them, absolutely none of them, not even one, has any amount of Native American DNA in them at all, but every single one of them all had a large amount of European DNA in their ancestry. We also show a clip in the film of the analysis that was done, of course, on the King Tut mummy that showed that King Tut had a European background as well. When we start to see that the lineage of these ancient peoples does not tie into the plan of how they can relegate and marginalize individual races, people, groups, and all this stuff, when we see that fly in the face of their ability to do, as you said, use this issue as a weapon, use this as a political tool, and then also at the same time also use it to enable them to keep the truth of these ancient sites covered up.
Right.
That's when they can't handle it, because the evidence is now flying in their face that this idea that, oh, it's this group or that group, or, you know, we're starting to find out now with DNA that I think everyone's origins now are definitely coming into question. As you mentioned earlier, the idea that this group or this people over here has right to this land, that is starting to become more and more every day an understood thing. This is a completely false ideology.
There's a lot actually behind that, and one of the best clips I've seen on this is actually Bill Will talking about an example of Lubbock, Texas, and the clip is like questioning whose is it, and I'm going to link that up, people, on the program page, and I suggest you take a look at that. We've linked it up a couple of times, but just to kind of spark some ideas in your head in terms of, you know, that issue as well of you know, why it's so, again, politicized, who showed up there first, who has the right to the land, how is this being, you know, transmuted today, and how is it being kind of, how is it passed back and forth in different hands? It seems like it's a one set of rules that apply to a certain people in certain circumstances when it comes to battling and fighting over territory and land, but it's a completely different attitude when it applies to all the other groups. So it's kind of, again, it's a political tool, and all we're trying to do here is to eradicate those double standards and say, okay, what applies to one applies to all, and that's just how it should be for the sake of being equal and fair in that regard. But take a look at that clip, folks. Bill Whittle, Whose Is It? And see what you think about that, because I think he makes a lot of sense there. Now,
interject something real quick. One of the biggest questions I get in all this is, you know, as you kind of mentioned earlier, I know we'll talk about this more later in the program, but, you know, one of the biggest questions I get is always, why would they cover this up? What is the need to cover all this up? Why would they not want people to know this? And just very quickly, I think that these dates, the farther back these dates go, the farther back that we see how old these civilizations are and who these people were, I think that that right there alone flies in the face of their ability to be able to use these racial associations or these group associations to explain away these ancient sites. When you start to see that, okay, this site's not 2,000 years old, as they told us, it's 250,000 years old, that right there smashes their ability to be able to associate that with a particular type of people, because their narratives show that these people were only in these lands for, you know, a few thousand years or whatever. All of these sites predate their narratives and their stories for when these racial groups and people would have inhabited these areas. And I think that really is one of the main reasons, not the only one, but one of the main reasons of the continued cover-up.
All right. Before we take a break here, Josh, let's just kind of talk a little bit about what you're doing right now. And also, of course, you're raising money for Volume 3. You're going to continue to travel around. We want to give out details, of course, how people can get their hands on both Volume 1 and Volume 2, which is the latest in the series. But then what's going on with Number 3, and what are you looking to do there?
Well, people can go to my website, theglobalreality.com, or they can just go to a search engine, type in Josh Reeves, and my website will be the first one that comes up. And there's a big banner on the top of my website that says, buy all of Josh Reeves' films here. Just click there. There's downloads. We have instant downloads of Volume 1 and Volume 2. They're only $15 each. You can also get Blu-rays, DVDs, whatever else. Volume 3, we're currently in production on. We've shot about just shy of half of that. But the thing with this one, Henrik, is that we have actually, since in the past year since Volume 1 has come out, we've, thanks to shows like yours and others, we've been able to reach a lot more people. So we've actually had people coming forward now saying, well, hey, you know, I heard you on Red Ice. hey, I've got this on my property, and no one's been on my property since before the Trail of Tears. We've never allowed anyone here. You know, do you want to come out and see this? You know, do you want to come out and get footage of a giant footprint we have in shale near a pre-flood mound in Alabama? I mean, people are really coming forward with some unbelievable things. We've got some stuff I can't even talk about. We're going to actually, in Volume 3, have some actual new discoveries. We're going to be showing some things in some sites that have never been filmed or even taken pictures of or anything. We're going to have some legitimate new finds in Volume 3 that no one's ever seen before, that the Smithsonian has not gotten their hands on yet. And, yes, that's why we're trying to raise the rest of what we need to finish Volume 3. And people can go there to my website, and there's a Indiegogo banner thing or a Kickstarter banner, whatever it may be. We use different ones, and they can make a contribution there. We have all kinds of great perks and packages for people to make contributions. And, of course, the more that you contribute, the bigger the package is. So there it is. Thank you, Hendrik, for that.
Thank you. TheGlobalReality.com. Head on over there. Check it out. The documentary again we're talking about is The Lost Secrets of Ancient America. A lot of interesting things in there. Stay with us, folks. Stay with us, Josh. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back. When we return, we'll continue with Josh Reeves in the second hour, and we have much more to discuss related to cover-ups and finds of both areas and structure on the American continent. We discuss Pyramid Lake, Shaco Canyon, Lovelock Cave, and the entire area of Ohio is a very rich area, like the Serpent Mound and the Newark Earthworks, etc. We also discuss the Lewis and Clark expedition and what they found. You can go to redicemembers.com and sign up for a membership and continue to listen to the second hour of this program. And, of course, get access to all our previous shows, videos, and additional material. Much more to come, folks. Thank you so much for staying with us. We'll be right back after the break.